In his new book, Almighty, Washington Post reporter Dan Zak re-examines America's love-hate relationship with the bomb, from the race to achieve atomic power before the Nazis did to the solemn 70th anniversary of Hiroshima. A life-or-death issue is unraveled in Zak's account, with a cast that includes the biophysicist who first educated the public on atomic energy, the prophet who predicted the creation of Oak Ridge, and the Washington bureaucrats and diplomats who are trying to keep the world safe. Zak shows that our greatest modern-day threat remains a power we discovered long ago. Dan Zak is a reporter for The Washington Post. He has written a wide range of news stories, narratives, and profiles while on local, national, and foreign assignments, from Oscar night in Los Angeles to the U.S. military drawdown in Iraq. And we welcome Dan Zak to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Again, the name of the book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. What brought you to the topic?
Well, the break-in that is at the center of the book is what brought me to the topic. It happened 4 years ago. This month, three peace activists broke into a nuclear weapons facility in East Tennessee in a city called Oak Ridge, and they hiked over a wooded ridge in the middle of the night and used bolt cutters to get past four fences and wound up spray painting and splashing blood on a facility that stores our enriched uranium, which is used in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. So the fact of this break-in and how crazy it seemed is what initially captured my attention. And when I tried to answer the questions therein, who are these people, what were they doing, why were they doing it, what is this site, that kind of led me into a longer exploration of the U.S. and its relationship to its nuclear weapons.
This facility known as Fort Knox of Uranium, so how did a house painter, a Vietnam veteran, and an 82-year-old Catholic nun get in?
Well, they got in fairly easily, which is the upsetting part of it. They had three pairs of bolt cutters, and they were essentially able to defeat or circumvent a $150 million a year security system. Cutting through the fences set off alarms, but there was a what the government would call a culture of complacency at this site that was dealing with many false alarms every day, and so these specific alarms were kind of brushed off initially as false alarms, and so they were able to kind of waltz into this site that, as you mentioned, has this nickname of the Fort Knox of uranium. It's supposed to be one of the most secure sites in the country and maybe the world. And, you know, these three people with normal household tools just kind of wandered in.
So the two big questions to come out of the book and ones that you want us to think of are, well, why do we continue to possess such large amounts of nuclear weaponry in the first place? And if we're going to do that, are we safe doing that?
Right. I mean, the U.S. government is fond of saying that the number of warheads in our stockpile has come down by 85% since its peak during the Cold War. And the Cold War has been over for 25 years now. And while the number of warheads has diminished, we still maintain a stockpile of around 7,000, and 4,000 of those are actually deployed on missiles and in submarines and near bomber bases. And so we still have, and Russia still has, enough nuclear weapons to end the world many times over. And you'd think that we would want only enough to end the world one time over, but we still have these enormous stockpiles. And one of the reasons is it's purely political. People look at them as political weapons. Even after the Cold War, we can't dare to have any fewer than Russia does, and we wouldn't want them to have any more. And so we're still locked in this Cold War-like stance that even though weapons have come down in number, we still have far too many in most people's estimations. And we're also just preparing to spend $1 trillion to modernize and overhaul the ones that remain. So we, 25 years after the Cold War, are prepared to extend the life of this arsenal well into the latter part of this century.
So why is it that we can get so, to use a term my father always used, jacked out of shape about, say, North Korea or Iran and their proliferation, which is understandable, but why aren't we equally as concerned by the weapons that we house ourselves?
You know, I think that's the question. We're concerned about other people's weapons or the weapons they have not yet attained in the case of Iran, but ours are kind of an afterthought. I think maybe it's because that we think that we are a perfectly capable country when it comes to national security, and we're responsible stewards of this atomic power, and everyone else is the suspect. As proven by this break-in that's the center of the book, you know, that's not always the case. You know, our history with our nuclear weapons is rife with near accidents, with misunderstandings, miscalculations, things going nearly horribly wrong. And, you know, I think the reason we don't think about them today is because we don't have a focusing agent like the Cold War. There's no longer this stare down with the Soviet Union when it seems like annihilation can come at any second. When really, I think, you know, I would argue that we should be as aware and as vigilant now as we were in the 60s or in the 80s when the Soviet Union was around, because of the fact that because humans are involved, we're never going to be 100% perfect with things. You know, and if the U.S. can't be perfect after spending so much money on securing these weapons, well, what is the situation in places like Pakistan, like India, who also have nuclear weapons? And what about North Korea, which is an opaque and intransigent country that is testing nuclear weapons? So I think there needs to remain a vigilance on the part of the public that is not as strong as it used to be during the Cold War.
The second part of the book is called Reaction, and you look at how what the reaction is to this break-in, but also to what the thought process was and what came out of it. And you start that section off by recalling some of the statements made by congressional leaders who called it appalling and bizarre and incredible and mind-boggling incompetence. But beyond that, where did it go?
Well, you know, Congress is very good about making statements. and, of course, making actions is a lot more difficult. And so, you know, the reaction to this break-in were congressional hearings, which was essentially a round after round of congressmen and women showing up and shaking their finger at the Department of Energy and at the contractors involved at the site, you know, saying, how could this happen? What if it were terrorists? You know, what do we do here? And it was essentially all talk. There were some security reforms at the site, as you would imagine. There, you know, they put more razor wire up. They retrained their security force. You know, you talk to people at the site there, and they're confident this kind of intrusion will not happen again. But in terms of the practical effect on broader nuclear weapons policy, you know, there wasn't much. It didn't even force Congress to really talk about why we have these weapons and what we're doing with them now and what we plan to do with them in the future, which is really the questions we should be asking and the questions the public should be concerned about, because we're about to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years to modernize this arsenal and to try and secure it to the best of our ability. I kind of wished that instead of finger-wagging contest in Congress after this action, there had been a more philosophical debate about what we're doing.
The activists obviously wanted to highlight and to show people that there were these stockpiles of deadly nuclear weapons. Were they surprised by the reaction, and also how quickly it then went to, well, what if these people were terrorists?
I think that they were surprised at how successful their action this intrusion that they had gotten so far. You know, they were calling it a miracle, actually. I think they had hoped that you know, they always hope for more public awareness and reaction. That's why they do this kind of what they view as civil resistance. Of course, the government views it as a crime, a felony. And I think they were happy to have prompted discussion in Congress. But I think ultimately, you know, there is a sense that the work will forever remain undone until there's actual concrete results. And if that means continuing to speak out and continuing to commit acts of civil resistance, that's what they'll have to do. I mean, this break-in, which is now 4 years ago, this month actually, in East Tennessee, is part of a long line of intrepid civil resistance going back to 1980, when the Berrigan brothers and others first broke into a nuclear weapons facility in Pennsylvania. You know, every couple of years this happens. There's a group of activists that break into a nuclear weapons facility just to try and remind the public that even though the Cold War is over, even though the numbers of warheads have come down a bit, they haven't gone away. And so I think that's going to keep happening until there's a wholesale change in what we're doing with them.
I don't want to give away the end of the book, but jail time was served in this.
Yeah, multiple years. They were charged not only with destruction of government property, but they were charged with intending to endanger the national defense, which is a fairly serious charge that carried up to 20 years in prison. They were convicted of that. They were not sentenced anywhere near 20 years. But they served about 2 years in prison all told. Until an appeals court said, you know what, this was not, they were not intending to disrupt the safety and security of the United States. This was an act of protest. Criminal, yes, but there was no reasonable person could convict them of intending to endanger the national defense. So they were actually released early in May of last year.
The name of the book is Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and the Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. We have about 30 seconds left, and in that time, when you look at the book coming out and the story being discussed, what do you hope comes as far as meaningful conversation?
Well, I just hope that there's an awareness out there. I mean, this book and wanting to do this book came from my own unawareness. I was born in 1983. I came of age after the end of the Cold War. Nuclear weapons did not have salience in my life. And they really should, for the amount of money that we spend on them or are prepared to spend on them, and the number that still exists in the world, both around the U.S. and in Russia and other nation states. So I just hope it reminds people that though the Cold War is over and though we're focused on other existential crises, terrorism, climate change, that nuclear weapons are still a real factor in the world.
Then again, the name of the book is Almighty. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Dan Zak, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Again, Dan Zak's new book is Almighty. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.